alle Menschen frei. Sein buntes Lied der Arbeit macht alle Menschen frei. Macht alle Menschen frei. Macht alle Menschen frei.
Er schloss die Türe auf und trat ins Zimmer des Lebens. Er war erwachsen geworden und betrachtete jeden Zentimeter seines Alters im Spiegel. Das ist es, sagte er. Dann stieg er durch das Fenster ins Freie, weil er sich an den Vogelkäfig, an den Vogelkäfig seiner Kindheit erinnerte. Und der Tag schön war.
That was Zeitstimmung by H.K. Gruber, performed by the composer himself with the BBC Philharmonic Orchestra, conducted by James McMillan. And that's all for this week. Next week, H.K. Gruber and the BBC Philharmonic return with a portrait concert of Alexander Gür, including the world premiere of his new piece, Tower Music.
Here and Now was presented by Ivan Hewitt and produced by Philip Tagney. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's nearly 3 minutes past midnight. Time now for the Early Music Show. It's presented by Lucy Skeeping.
Welcome to the show. If you're just sitting down to a nice, healthy lunch, spare a moment's thought for our ancestors. Back in the 18th century, a typical main meal was not for the faint-hearted. A multi-dish extravaganza, it could include a thick soup, fish, oysters, beef, poultry, grouse, sweetmeats and puddings. And that might be after a breakfast of anchovies washed down with a pint of beer. I mention this because today we're focusing on the eating habits of one of 18th century England's great gourmets, George Frederick Handel. Assuming music was his first pleasure, the second for this famously unmarried composer seems to have been food. And by the sound of it, the more of it the better. Indeed, we have the pictures to prove it. Contemporary engravings show Handel as the proud owner of a seriously supersized belly, his waistcoat buttons under considerable strain. So let's not beat about the bush. The composer of some of the most exquisite operas, oratorios and royal odes ever written was undeniably one of life's fatties. I wanted to explore more about all this, so a few weeks ago I met up with one of our best-loved cooks, Clarissa Dixon Wright, to discuss eating and drinking habits in Handel's day. But first, a little music from Belshazzar's Feast to whet your appetite. Thank you.
Clarissa, thanks very much for being with us. Judging by Handel's size in the various etchings I've seen, he does look as if he was a man who enjoyed his food. Let's talk a little bit about the sort of meals, first of all, that someone like Handel at his levels of society, someone living in a smart Mayfair house, would have had. I mean, I assume he would have had a live-in cook. Would he have planned meals with her?
He would have had a live-in cook and housekeeper, and he would have given her instructions. He might have been a male cook, but more likely to be a female. And he'd have said, oh, I think I'll have oysters today or whatever. But by and large, she'd very quickly get an idea of what he liked to eat and would have gone out and shopped accordingly. Yes, he had a very robust figure. Those of us that have more to offer do like our food.
So where would she have gone to buy it? There obviously wasn't a local supermarket at Hanover Square.
Well, I think there was a market there. They had little markets all over London on different days of the week, which the vegetable growers south of the river would have bought produce up to. There would have been a butcher. Or she might have gone to Smithfield to buy meat. And, of course, Billingsgate to buy fish. But a lot of stuff was sold to the door. You know, street hawkers coming round selling fish or milk or whatever. So there was plenty of access to food. It wasn't difficult to shop in those days. And, you know, even the big markets, Borough Market, was at its height at that point. So she wouldn't have had difficulty in buying stuff.
How would the diet of someone like Handel have differed, say, from a similar person nowadays? Was it richer?
I think because they had no central heating, you ate a lot more fat. The meals at that stage were not served in courses as we know them. They had what were known as removes, so you had three removes. The first one tended to be, it's rather like a Chinese restaurant. You had a whole lot of dishes put on the table at the same time. So you would have fish and perhaps an apple pie or something like that at the same time. And then you'd have meat or game, but different dishes, and vegetables in dishes. And then the final remove would have been fruit and candied fruit. And I mean, by this time, there was a lot of sugar. And so you would have just helped yourself from the different dishes, and then they'd have gone back to the kitchen where the servants would have eaten.
Oh!
Music from Act Two of Handel's oratorio Belshazzar's Feast. Anthony Rolfe Johnson was Belshazzar, demanding a second helping of vino, along with the English concert and choir, directed by Trevor Pinnock. Not many people in 18th century England, of course, would have feasted on that kind of biblical scale. But in Handel's time, even everyday meals seemed to have been a good deal richer than we're used to today. And for the more comfortably off, at least, the tradition of eating out was becoming more and more popular. I asked Clarissa Dixon Wright about the famous chop houses which seem to be popping up all over London during this period.
Oh, indeed. I mean, there are still chop houses. They keep trying to make comebacks. But in those days, it was very much part of a gentleman's way of life, was you would go, you probably wouldn't have lunch at home. You'd go out after breakfast. And lunch was a new idea because the whole dinner thing was getting later and later. Dinner used to be the middle of the day meal, and then it started getting moved forward and moved forward. So nuncheon or luncheon was a whole new idea, and a gentleman would go into a chop house and have a pint of porter and a chop. Then he would eat his evening meal probably about 6 o'clock at home. The other great thing, of course, was the growth of the chocolate houses at this point, which then became coffee houses. And this was where men met to discuss business. I mean, White's Chocolate House, which was in St James's, was very racy in those days. It was where you went to play cards and lose your money.
Are we talking about liquid chocolate drink rather than bars of chocolate?
No, liquid chocolate. No, they didn't have bars of chocolate. And in fact, chocolate wasn't particularly sweet then. It was more of a savoury drink. It had come over from Spain and of course, the Spanish had brought it back from the New World, and it was much thicker and richer and would give you an energy high in a way that modern chocolate doesn't particularly. It was very concentrated, and they would have it with some of the spices that were coming out of India, a little cardamom or something like that, and then hang about and read the newspapers. The chocolate houses used to take all the subscription newspapers, and, you know, that's what led then to the Gentleman's Club.
And apparently you could pick up your tickets for Handel's opera at Mr. White's Chocolate House.
Oh, really? What a clever idea. I didn't know that. No, that's very good.
Romilda,
Lewis, you mentioned spices a moment ago. This was, I suppose, quite a new thing, that the spices from exotic lands.
Well, they'd started coming in since the Middle Ages after the Second Crusade. But what was new was all the Indian spices, and certainly things like chilies. The Nawabs would come back from India, having made their fortune. And by this time, their palates were sort of attuned to chilies and relishes and pickles and ketchups. And so this was all part and parcel of what was then coming into English society and was regarded as very novel and avant-garde. And, you know, you get descriptions of people tasting curry at the home of some relative who'd come back from India and thinking it was incredibly hot. But the curry that was in Hannah Glass, which was written in 1745, was actually, by our standards, delicious but incredibly mild. And then by the time she wrote the third edition, which was about 7 or 8 years later, it was actually quite hot. And so you had a lot of the Indian spices and the ones you hadn't got before, like cumin and coriander and as I said, the sort of pickles and relishes and ketchups, which were much the fashion of the day, you know, food-gazing fashions. And at the beginning of Handel's stay in England, he would have been eating that. And then by the end of it, he'd have been eating capers and anchovies and all the things he would have tasted in Italy, because that's where the fashion moved on to.
Now, whenever I have a hot curry, the first thing I grab, I'm afraid, is the water to cool me down. But of course, in Handel's time, it wouldn't have been a very safe thing to do, and they tended to go for alcohol, even if they were just quenching their thirst.
Well, yes. I mean, small beer, as it was called, which was very weak beer, was the favoured drink on a daily basis, and then you had the stronger ales and. And, of course, wine, endless bottles of wine, and port. Port was beginning to become fashionable.
Actually, in the score of one of Handel's operas, Circe, it's just one of these great little things that's come down to us, in his own writing, he scribbled what must be a kind of shopping list, or at least some sort of aide-memoir. It says 12 gallons of port and 12 bottles of French red wine. He must have just suddenly occurred to him while he was in the throes of composing.
Well, he'd probably been having a party and may have thought that he was going to see his wine merchant later on, because you didn't have off-licences. An off-licence was part of a pub, but society gentlemen and rich impresarios and whatever would have had it delivered. I mean, a lot of those wine merchants in St. James's were all there at the time and would deliver your order. And so perhaps while he was writing, he thought, oh, I'll see Giles later. I must give him my order.
Mi confesso reo, son pazzo a fe, egli ha smarrito me. Forse per questo monte ei se ne andò. No, ch'io non veggo no, ma qual adombra il ciel nubile oscuro. Sento che non te fremo, sento che l'aria sfida, son restato e oscuro. Voglio partire in fretta, si spezza il ponte, a te, favor, gambetta. Perché nemico al mio temperamento, è l'acquoso elemento. Nel mio caro d'acqua amabile, nel mio impero suo potabile, ma non solo t'abitar. Nel mio caro bacco amabile, nell'impero suo potabile, a non solo abitare. Acqua rende ipocondriaco, il buon misil del zodiaco, la mia testa va in alto.
Dear sweet Bacchus, water makes a man a hypochondriac, but a decent wine sends my head soaring into the heavens. Another bibulous musical moment from Handel, this time from his opera Circe. Antonio Abete with Les Arts Florissants, directed by William Christie. As a mover in high society, Handel regularly got invited to some pretty fabulous supper parties. I asked Clarissa about one particular friend of his, the Earl of Burlington, who was famously keen on al fresco dining.
Oh, the Earl of Burlington, who was one of the Cavendishes, had this picnic house called Chiswick House, which is still there. You can go and wander around the gardens and indeed the house, which was solely built for daily excursions. They'd go down the river and all they would do was eat al fresco and have a lovely time and probably romp about in the bushes a bit and then go back to London at the end of the day. It has no bedrooms in it. It has rooms for retiring.
What sort of things would they have eaten on the picnic?
They ate a lot of oysters. They had sort of little oyster patties and lobster patties and, again, chops. They were great ones for having cold chops in aspic, which is delicious. They would have had terrines and cheese, fruit and vegetables, and little sort of concoctions. Bearing in mind they didn't have refrigeration, it was slightly difficult to do things en gelée, anything like that. Certainly would have had cold fish, probably not cold salmon, because salmon is still regarded as a rather common fish. It was something you fed to your workers, and every so often the London apprentices would riot and be promised they wouldn't have salmon more than three times a week because the salmon were all coming up the Thames still. You know, the Thames was a great place for picnics. I mean, we know that Handel went down to Greenwich with parties of his society friends, and they would go down and they would eat this freshwater fish soup called water sushi, which was made with fresh fish and watercress, and wait for the whitebait shoals to come up the Thames. And then the fishermen would haul in the nets and bring the whitebait to the tavern, where they were instantly floured and thrown in the fat and eaten in your fingers. And this was something that was very fashionable to do and a good fun for a day's outing.
Music from Handel's Water Music, the English concert directed by Trevor Pinnock. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Lucy Skeeping, and today, with the help of the cook, Clarissa Dixon-Wright, I'm exploring the eating habits of 18th century England, in particular those of that great foodie, Handel. Mind you, when it comes to our national dish, some things never change.
When mighty roast beef was the Englishman's food, it ennobled our veins and enriched our blood. Our soldiers were brave and our courtiers were good. Ooh, the roast beef of old England and old English roast beef. But since we have learned from all vapour in France to eat their ragouts as well as to dance, we are fed up with nothing but vain complaisance. Ooh, the roast beef of old England and old English roast beef.
There's a very famous Hogarth engraving showing the English as le roast beef and the Frenchman lying down in the street having eaten far too much soup. Very much caricatures the two different nations. What is this thing about roast beef? Was that such a big part of the diet?
Well, the thing you have to remember about a beef herd is that what you need to raise a successful beef herd is peace. And since the Norman invasion, England was not invaded. All right, it had its civil war, but, I mean, that was a very middle-class war. You wouldn't have disturbed your neighbour's cattle. And so the herds were allowed to flourish and grow and produce better beef. And then the time we're talking about now is the beginning of the agricultural revolution, where largely the gentry from Norfolk Turnip Townsend and Cook of Holkham and Horace Walpole were breeding better quality beef and sheep. And so the English were always depicted as le roast beefs. I mean, it's in Shakespeare, isn't it, in Henry V? But in fact, what they probably ate was mutton because, of course, we were a nation of wool providers.
What an underrated dish, mutton, actually. It's a good taste.
I love mutton, absolutely. And they would have, you know, if Handel had been having his chop, it would have been a mutton chop, not a lamb chop, which is a rather more substantial chop with a lot more flavour.
In those days, if fleets did presume on the main, they seldom or never returned back again, as witness the vaunting armada of Spain. Oh, the roast beef of old England, and old English roast beef. Oh, then we had stomachs too patent to fight, and when wrongs were a-cooking to do ourselves right. But now we're a... I could, but good night. Oh, the roast beef of old England, and old English roast beef.
The Roast Beef of Old England, written by one of London's leading opera singers, Richard Leveridge, the tune of which, incidentally, was played on the Titanic 3 times a day to call everyone to the dining room, which may or may not be a recommendation. When it came to fine dining, Handel's love of food is well documented. One biographer wrote of his great appetite, another called him somewhat large and corpulent, and another commented on how his great weight rendered his gait awkward. In fact, there's a series of rather vicious cartoons, engravings, which portray Handel at the organ, bloated and pig-faced, surrounded by symbols of gluttony. The artist was at one time friend of the composer, Joseph Goopy. Apparently he and Handel met in the street by chance one day. Handel invited Goopy home to dine with him, but warned that only plain food, as he called it, was available. The simple meal over, Handel suddenly got up from the table and disappeared, saying that he had work to attend to. As time passed, Goopy became curious, wandered into an adjacent room and spied Handel in the back parlour scoffing himself with food. Such delicacies, Goopy recalled, as he had lamented his inability to afford his friend. Leaving the house in anger, Handel's now ex-friend soon put pen to paper, and by the wonders of the modern photocopier, Clarissa Dixon Wright and I could study the results.
In one of the cartoons, hanging out of Handel's pocket of his frock coat is a shopping list which includes sausages, capon, tart, a cod and quails. Would that have been typical of a diet at this time?
Yes, all those things would have been things that were eaten quite readily. Sausages were, as they remain to this day, extremely popular. And they used to make much more lavish sausages than we do now. When you get these specialist sausage makers, I think, well, they ain't got nothing on what they were doing in the 18th century, where they were putting things like coxcombs and... tongue and things like that into the sausages. I tried making one once, but I couldn't get it to stay together.
You mean without mincing it? Sort of throwing it into the skin?
In with the mince. So you get your basis of force meat, pork, minced pork, and then they'd put other things into it, like, as I said, coxcombs. Coxcombs were still quite popular as a little snack. They were something you would have had at the theatre, stuffed with artichoke hearts. All sorts of things like that going into your sausage. But I couldn't get a skin that was either large enough or stout enough to make it.
So a capon, was that more of a sort of casserole or soup chicken? You wouldn't have roasted one?
You would have roasted it on a spit, and in fact it would be more successful on the spit than a chicken, because chickens were quite small in those days, and it would have had a lot more fat so that it wouldn't have dried out so I'd say quickly. Of course, at this stage, one's still... cooking in over an open fire. They didn't have closed ovens except in baker shops. And so it would have been either roasted or all those dishes like coq au liqui or sort of the equivalents in France of a sort of pot-au-feu or whatever. You would have used a capon. If you could afford a capon, you'd use a capon.
There's also a nice bit of ham sort of hanging up from the top of the organ in one of these pictures, the sort of thing you might see in a an Italian delicatessen today?
Rather a small ham. I mean, there's a letter from Sidney Smith, who is very much of this period, and he's sending a ham to somebody in London, and he says, I write to you lest the carrier should change it because it weighs 30 pounds. I mean, it'd be hard put to get a 30-pound ham nowadays.
part of Handel's Alexander's Feast. Bacchus' blessings are a treasure. Drinking is the soldier's pleasure. Michael George and the 16, directed by Harry Christophers. Like many ambitious young musicians, Handel spent some years studying in Italy. So would he have got a taste for traditional Italian food, like, say, pasta?
You know, on the basis that all good things came from Rome originally, I mean, Italy was still the heartland of food. When Catherine de Medici went across the Alps to marry Francis II, the French cooks went to the king to petition him to stop the incursions of Italian cooks because they cooked so much better. I mean, one of the things he would definitely have had would have been ice cream. They used to bring the snow down from the mountains, the ice down from the mountains, and put it in the ice houses, and then mix it with fruit juices, and you would have had it in certainly in the opera house. There's a charming diary of a young man who went on a grand tour and went to the opera in Milan and was appalled to discover that, you know, not only did all the people in the boxes talk all the time and make a terrible racket, but when people came round with ice cream, they'd be shouting, "Hey, over here," and whatever. So it was almost impossible to hear the opera. They didn't bother with intervals. They just kept going and wandering in and out. And I suppose that he would have had pasta. I mean, certainly there was pasta. Whether he would have eaten it or not, I don't know. In Italian society, it's...
Was that considered perhaps more peasant food?
No, I think the Italians have always eaten pasta at any level of society. And they probably would have eaten not spaghetti, but they'd sort of something like tagliatelle with truffles, white truffles, which to this day still remains one of the most delicious things, I think. Though, yes, of course, he would have had a lovely time eating Italian food.
And also composing some of his most glorious music, like Dixit Dominus.
talk a little bit about the so-called healthy living, because at one point we know, well, at least one point we know that Handel retired to Tunbridge Wells Spa. The water was felt to be helpful. Would they also have had special health-giving foods down there?
No, I don't think they worried about things like that. What would have been the most health-giving thing about going to the spa, apart from the waters, would have been the fact that they didn't drink alcohol. So they gave their livers a rest. And I mean, it's something that certainly in my generation was still very fashionable in France. The French used to go off to spas to relieve their livers. But it was part of society. You know, the fashionable went to Tunbridge Wells and then they all moved to Bath and wherever everybody was going. And it was very difficult to find a house to rent in the more fashionable spa towns at the height of the season. And also it got you out of London with all its smells and miasmas and diseases.
Well, my thanks to Clarissa Dixon-Wright for her tasty insights into the eating and drinking habits of Handel and his time. By the beginning of 1751, it seems that Handel's health was having a serious effect on his work. He just returned from a trip to Germany and now began working on a new oratorio, Jephtha. But a note he made in the score suggests that he was in some difficulty. "Reached here on 13th of February," he scribbled, "but unable to continue owing to relaxation of the sight of my left eye." Now in his early 60s, and suffering from gout and bowel problems, blindness was clearly setting in. And at the end of the season, Handel took himself off to Bath and Cheltenham spas to take the waters, hoping for a cure. This did nothing to improve his sight, but he did manage to complete Jephtha. And, among other things, his final instrumental work, the Organ Concerto Opus 7, No. 3.
Thank you.
Copeland with the first movement of Handel's Organ Concerto, Opus 7, Number 3. The composer's enthusiasm for good food continued throughout his life until, that is, his general health began to worsen. Indeed, in 1759, the year of his death, Handel had obviously become uncharacteristically frail. His biographer and friend Mannering remarked on his lack of appetite, which must prove more pernicious, he wrote, to a person always habituated to an uncommon portion of food and nourishment. Handel passed away that April, and the following month his Messiah was given, as usual, at the Foundling Hospital, this time conducted by his long-time assistant, John Christopher Smith. So let's end the programme with part of that work, the Taverner Choir and Players, directed by Andrew Parrott, with the chorus, His Yoke is Easy.
Yeah. Hello and welcome to BBC Radio 3 Through the Night with me, Jonathan Swain. A concert now with the Swedish Radio Symphony Orchestra. It's actually a compilation of two concerts they gave early in 2009, ending with the Rachmaninoff Third Piano Concerto. And it opens with Raphael Friedrich de Burgos conducting Respighi's Pines and Fountains of Rome. The fountains first, four of them, all pictured at different times of the day. The second of them, the Triton Fountain in the morning, is followed by the Trevi Fountain at midday, as Respighi put it himself. Across the surface of the water, there passes Neptune's chariot, drawn by seahorses in a spectacular procession. And this first one, the Julia Valley Fountain at daybreak.
Bye.